This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Thank you very much. And first, I'd just like to say thank you to Jeanette Walker, who invited me here. And we hadn't met before, so it was an invitation out of the blue. But to be paired with an oceanographer of the Navy is quite an interesting collaboration. So I'm very interested to see how this will work out. But I also kind of wanted to say thank you very much this morning for the stories you shared with us. It's very unusual to have this kind of coupling, and so all credit to the organizers for bringing that together. And I hope that there was a lot of mention about obligation, and I hope that we can be adequate listeners, because I think in climate change, certainly in Western discourses, we haven't been very adequate listeners to the voice of Indigenous peoples. And it was very heartening and to see the way in which those configurations of groups and that solidarity is demanding its political space. So that made me feel quite optimistic about climate change. But I'm going to actually talk today about frames of climate and climate and the geopolitical imagination and why these kind of images matter, but also what the kind of relationship between these images and geopolitics might be. So it's obviously well recognized that climate poses a number of representational challenges. And we've talked about this a little bit this morning. So it's multi-sided, it's multi-scalar, and it's extraterritorial. Yet it seems quite reticent as an event. It's very difficult to actually point to climate change, even though climate change is already happening. So one of the issues around communicating climate change has been about climate change and non-representation and how we kind of configure the event of climate change that's both absent and present at the same time. And a lot of that is about the kind of absence of the voices that are kind of within climate change. So what I'm going to do today is really just talk to some ideas about climate change and the geographical imagination and try and sort of make some connections between aesthetics and politics and talk about the logics that underpin imagination. And then I'm going to kind of suggest that we need a vigilant catastrophe and a kind of to reclaim the catastrophe as a way of thinking about climate change. So climate change, obviously, as we've heard this morning, presents a novel form of precarity. It's excessive in its planetary claims and its kind of relation with the future. We don't know how climate change will kind of play the future, as it were. So it's this exorbitant event that's likely to shatter our current social formations. And I think abrupt climate change is something that isn't in the kind of Western imagination in the way that it probably needs to be at the moment. Because often the responses to climate change are quite simplistic or they're pragmatic. They fold climate change back into existing economies of reason. So I just want to give an example to really ground this. And just we've seen lots of images already around the flood and this kind of notion of the flooded imagination. So there's this kind of imagination of a liquidity that's going to absorb us and absorb the future. But very quickly, this language of the flood, this kind of imagery of the flood, actually translates into a geopolitical framing. So there's this move from the geophysical to the geopolitical. And that happens very quickly, but it also shifts the frame of how we think about climate change. So we move from a question of environmental justice to a question of securitization. Securitization of populations and a kind of a threatened notion of climate change, which is being kind of mobilized at the state level. So there's this kind of move from, there's this bleed from the geo-imaginary to the geopolitical. And that sets in certain kind of political sensibilities of the world. And what this often does is kind of discipline the space between precarity and injustice, while actually kind of not noticing the very violences that are at stake. And I think this morning a sense of what those violences might be, but that kind of violence is often excluded from a lot of Western discourses on climate change. So I kind of want to reclaim that violence. And often the question is kind of posed in this kind of, it moved from a sort of human security to a national security. And I think there's issues at stake in how we represent those that kind of experience climate change. And actually whether we shift from a dialogue of talking about human precarity to issues of national security. And I think there's going to be some very interesting questions that are raised with the next talk as well, and how we bring these two things together. So we know climate change has kind of complex spatial effects, and we also know that there's this kind of spatial irony at work in terms of climate change, that those that are least responsible are kind of most impacted by climate change. So we might want to think about climate change as being inseparable from issues of global power. And how we deal with global power and how we deal with global politics is also a kind of climate change issue. So hopefully that's got to show how aesthetics and politics might work together in configuring the event of climate change. And what I want to do is actually just talk to these two moments of climate change that I think our current moment is embodying. And that's the notion that the catastrophe has already happened. We're used to kind of thinking of climate change as something kind of configured by futurity. But actually, from what we've heard today, the catastrophe has already happened. In terms of greenhouse gas emissions, that we're already committed to a future with climate change and possibly abrupt climate change. And yet, at the same time that the catastrophe has already happened, the catastrophe is actually very hidden. It's not very evident in our responses, in the way we configure response to the event. So what I'd like to kind of propose is that we think about a vigilant catastrophe, how we kind of reclaim the geographical imaginary of the catastrophe into a kind of vigilant catastrophe that's aware of the forms and the tropes of catastrophe, but actually re-engages with the power of the catastrophe, re-engages with loss and trauma. So this term vigilant catastrophe, I'll just Google search and see what comes up. It's often kind of a good way to find out what other kind of imaginaries are circling. And this is what came up, actually. FEMA, thinking the unthinkable, and the whole community planning for the unthinkable. So obviously catastrophe is out there as a term that's already doing some work in terms of disaster management. So the role of catastrophe and catastrophic images, I'm sure you're all aware of these, have been kind of prevalent in climate change social formation, particularly in popular culture, but also in terms of the planning around climate change in social policy and the geopolitics of climate change. But at the very same time, there's this real backlash against catastrophe and this kind of regulation of catastrophe into a genre or into a discursive category. So we kind of hear the term catastrophic thinking, doom-laden narratives, and there's a lot of work that points to the depoliticization of these narratives. So how do we kind of bring that together with the kind of fear and hopes and real kind of trauma that climate change is already unleashing and will continue to unleash? How do we kind of reclaim this notion of catastrophe? So what I'd like to suggest is that already there's some engagements with kind of the creative role of catastrophe that may not be kind of quite so disempowering. So I think to kind of put everything that is kind of deals with loss into that sort of basket of catastrophic thinking actually misses the real work that's done by creative fiction, by film, etc., to actually kind of unearth the experience of the catastrophe. So there's just some texts up there that deal with that. So if the apocalypse is the kind of master metaphor of contemporary environmental imagination, how do we kind of reoccupy this imagination in ways that are kind of politically effective? So Lawrence Buell suggests that the rhetoric of apocalypse implies that the fate of the world hinges on the arousal of the imagination to a sense of crisis. And he suggests that this framing reveals the greatest threat is the kind of perception of the threat rather than kind of the threat itself. So how the problem is perceived, Janet raised this morning, is kind of a crucial part of how we configure our responses to the effect. So there's this kind of double-edged sword of catastrophic imaginations. It's kind of a well-ordered, established critique, particularly here, often produced from Hollywood as this kind of a dynamic event. But it's also something that we actually have to learn to live with. We have to learn to live with the small catastrophes of climate change and some of the very large traumatic ones. So there's this kind of cusp that we're living on, I think, in terms of the catastrophe, in terms of trying to prefigure it, to imagine it before it sort of arrives, but clearly it's already arriving. So this cusp of the sort of imagining the unimaginable that I've been very interested in. So I just want to give you an illustration of how the catastrophe has already happened and how it's hidden and just connect these two things together. So obviously, we've moved out now of what's often referred to as the happy Holocene. You have to read Ice Core Graphs from right to left. But that basic... that stability there is, that's what we call culture. And we're about to leave that state, according to the science, and actually move into a territory that is very unknown and very kind of challenging to how we think about maintaining a notion of our kind of current cultural formations. So we're already committed to climate change. We're already in climate change. But actually, we can see from the observation of ICE data that actually the world is now providing a better model than climate models. And that's quite a shift from the kind of imaginary of climate models, of configuring the world through simulations, to actually witnessing in the world. So this is the kind of, the mapping of ICE data, and you can see the actual observations actually deviate from even the kind of broadest range of the models. And we've also had recently data on the Greenland ice sheet that paints a very kind of dramatic picture of Greenland ice melt, and also in the Antarctic, the warming of the West Antarctic ice sheet. Okay, so the catastrophe is already in the world. But then the catastrophe is hidden. Catastrophic ice melt was actually excluded from the IPCC because it was too unpredictable to be included in the IPCC fourth assessment. So at the same time that we've got the catastrophe in the world, we've also got it hidden in terms of our policy tools. So it was actually removed because it was too unpredictable to be included, and also the warming of the oceans. So this kind of raises a question for me about the excess of uncertainty. So there is both a kind of question about knowledge and a question about representation and what we might do about it. So this is where I come to my kind of vigilant catastrophe, how we kind of recuperate the imagination, the catastrophic imagination, and actually begin to bring this excess back in. And that's about bringing these kind of stories that challenge us, and they challenge, you know, essentially our kind of Western habitats to be different. Because we're obviously talking now about kind of shifts, both social and biophysical shifts that really challenge kind of life itself. And you know, we heard that this morning in the kind of trauma of relocation. And so There's a kind of question about recuperating the role of witnessing, recuperating this kind of trauma as an effective politics. And we've seen this here today. I mean, normally you don't hear, well, you hear about kind of impact on indigenous communities, but you don't actually hear from indigenous people. And that's one of the, in the social policy and science arena, that's a real problem. Because the witness gets, the indigenous witness gets configured as a victim, not an active political voice. And this is a real problematic that we need to start addressing. So I think, you know, one of the things to think about is the where, when, and who of climate. Who's at the table, who's excluded, and where are these images being produced from? And the entirety of kind of climate change as a science has been configured through general circulation models, and that collaboration with both kind of ice core data and various other forms of empirical data. But what kind of world does this produce? What kind of globe and what kind of inhabitation does this produce? These are kind of speculative productions of the future. But who can inhabit these productions? How are we represented? And it's an interesting question because humans come after Earth processes in climate modeling. So humans have to act like a cloud. Humans have to kind of act like an Earth process because of the way in which science has led the production of climate knowledge. And we also have, so we need to kind of think about this whole Earth, object Earth, what kind of object we're making in terms of a world object and who's involved in it. But now we have this new term on the block that kind of rolls in global environmental change and climate change into the Anthropocene. And the Anthropocene is the is the proposition from the Geologic Society that we are now a geomorphic force. So we are now operating on the same scale as kind of asteroids and volcanoes, and it reads humans as a kind of, as a future trace in the strata through an extinction event. So it's kind of connecting us back to the catastrophe, but it's also problematic in the same way that those global models are problematic, is that it doesn't differentiate between different groups of people, and it doesn't kind of have any kind of acknowledgement of, you know, of greenhouse gas emissions and the kind of differentiated subjectivities within there. So what it proposes is that the human imprint on the global environment is now so large and active that it rivals some of the great forces of nature. So it's a new imaginary of ourselves as geomorphic, ourselves as an Earth process. But it's also a homogeneous rendering of kind of climate change. Responsibility is kind of smeared across the planet, which is very problematic for issues of mitigation. So the when of climate change has also been important in representations. How we understand the logics of time, how we frame time in climate change has been incredibly important to the political imaginaries of what to do about it. And I just put the sort of most common framings of climate times here. And that's to kind of the first one to present time as a kind of sum of past and future, so that the future and the past are enrolled in the demands of the present. The second one is the kind of future is the telos of the past, so that's what the Anthropocene is doing. It's kind of imagining humanity through its end, the ends of man, the ends of the world, and actually kind of trying to backcast to what we might do about climate emissions. And the third one is the kind of imaginary of futures as a sphere of action. This is most closely allied with sustainability discourses and how we kind of inframe the present in order to kind of change the future. And I think the fourth one, which is the most politically potent, is the notion of the future as a kind of possibility, as a possibility to live in different ways and live in kind of potentially more kind of respectful ways in terms of climate justice. So again, the sort of third thing that I wanted to just kind of bring up, but I don't really need to because it's already been spoken to this morning, is the kind of who of climate change. Who's excluded from the frame? Who's actually owns the means of production to tell their stories rather than have other stories told about them? And I think this is obviously a very important part, and this is where kind of film and media, I think, play a really great big role in configuring, you know, kind of new stories of climate change that are not told from a Western perspective, where the actual means of production are owned by indigenous groups. So I just want to move on from there to think about how we actually respond to the event in a way that is generous to the enormity of that event. And this is a kind of, we've had a lot of responses to climate change that have been about making new markets, folding back kind of climate issues into current policy tools. But how do we kind of respond to the event in a way that really addresses the enormity of what's at stake, and in a way that is generous to that? So a lot of the thinkers that I'm very influenced by were writing at the time of the Second World War. And particularly they were interested in this relationship in terms of representation between the judicial nature of representation as a giving voice and the kind of ecstatic nature of representation, of how you represent the unrepresentable. And that kind of question of the dual nature of representation. And that's also kind of, I think, speaks to some of the questions around obligation that were raised this morning about representation. How those that are obliged to respond are actually kind of, you know, begin to take that obligation seriously. So my interest has been in this kind of excessive knowledge and excessive representation. So I think this is obviously a kind of continuing question for us here in terms of sea level rise, but also in terms of climate justice much more generally. So I just want to read you a quote from Maurice Blanchot, and he just asks the question, why does a and he's writing in light of the nuclear bombs, Second World War, but also in the kind of concentration camps, of kind of this trying to speak to the unspeakable. And he says, why does a question so serious, since it holds the future of humanity in its sway, a question such as that to answer, it would suppose a radically new thinking, why does it not renew the language that conveys it? And he responds, if thinking falls back on its traditional affirmations, it's because it wants to risk nothing of itself in the process of an ambiguous event. And what he's saying here is that there's a tendency to engage with climate change and say, yes, we must change, and then do nothing. We don't respond, we don't change the language in which we respond to the event. And that's what he's trying to speak to there, is how we risk ourselves. And I think that this question of obligation is very kind of key in that understanding of how we risk ourselves, how we both notice our obligation and actually risk ourselves to respond to that obligation and not carry on business as usual, which has been the kind of way in which our kind of current responses to climate change have been business as usual. Greenhouse gas emissions haven't been reduced. We've generated new tools to kind of marketize climate change without any kind of impact on emissions. So how we actually become attentive to changing a new language, and this is where I think communication and aesthetics and joining up with the political, joining up with these kind of social movements has a role to play. So what I'd like to leave you with is just this kind of suggestion that we kind of develop an aesthetics of kind of vigilant catastrophe in the Anthropocene, and one that's much more generous and much more fitting to the enormity of the event. Thank you.
Okay, I think everybody can hear me, yes? Great, I will try to keep this to 25 minutes here. I understand I get the hook at 25 and 15 seconds if I don't, so I will do so. Thanks to the organizers. This has been a very, very interesting conference. Lots of stimulating conversation, both inside here and, frankly, in the sidebars as well. So I appreciate that. Let me try to do two things. Of course, the danger of doing two things is you may not do either of them well, but I will attempt to do this. I'm going to try and actually talk about sea level rise, and I'm going to try to talk about communications, both for climate change writ large and also on the somewhat more specific topic of sea level rise. You can read what I'm going to say. Okay. Climate change. How do you take all of this stuff and how do you frame it or talk about it in the, you know, infamous cliched elevator speech to somebody who may or may not know, probably has a lot of misconceptions, and, you know, really, you know, just hears little bits and pieces from, you know, reputable sources like Fox, stuff like that. And I'm going to put it in national security terms here. So my first rule on communication is I can't remember more than three things. So when somebody gives me a list of six, hey, that's really interesting, but I probably tuned out. The Navy used to have this wonderful maritime strategy. It was worked at the Naval War College, the brightest minds in national security, da-da-da. There were six things in it. Nobody could remember it. We now have three. I'll show that to you later. So here's my three things for climate change. First, it's people, not polar bears. I like polar bears. You know, they're nice. They're cuddly, they're fuzzy, all that. And when you type in, as was mentioned by the previous speaker, just go to your Google. I know half of you, well, 80% of you have your internet in here. Type in Google, go to climate change, type images, and while I'm talking, you guys can like count the number of Arctic polar bear-like images on there. You'll see it's about a third. It's about a third. And while, yes, polar bears are cute and cuddly and iconic and charismatic megafauna and all that sort of stuff, you know, when you're trying to pay your mortgage, wonder about your health care, wonder how your kid's going to afford UCSB, all that kind of daily stuff tends to crowd out polar bears. So the more you can talk about climate change as it's about you, you personally, your family, your children, your neighbors, your village, your city, it tends to resonate a lot more. So it's people, not polar bears. It's all about the water. And we've kind of heard some of this already today. I say it explicitly. Of course, there's more than water. I know that. But if you think about so much of climate change, it does come down to water. It's a pretty good unifying concept. When I think about water, it's too much, too little, wrong place, wrong time. It's wet where you thought it was going to be dry. It's salty where you thought it was going to be fresh. It's liquid where you thought it was going to be solid. It's a massive distribution, and it really impacts things. Just for fun, this came out of the U.S. Geological Survey. That's all the water in the world. That is a sphere about 860, give or take, miles in diameter. That's all the water in the world. This one here, which is about, I think it's about 80 miles in diameter, that's all the fresh water in the world. And if you can see, that is not a speck on the screen. The AV guys did a nice job of making it clean. That is the usable fresh water. You know, it sort of would cover the city of Atlanta. It's not very much. And that's what we have to live on. And if we start skirting around with this in climate change, we're going to have an issue. And oh, by the way, yeah, without water, you have a problem with food. And increasingly, energy is highly correlated with water as well. But it's all about water. So we have people, not polar bears. It's all about the water. Remember these guys? What did they say? It was the economy stupid, right? Yeah, it's the economy stupid. Well, I would say for climate change, it's the change part of climate change, and Catherine kind of alluded to this, the happy Holocene, that stability. You know, it's not like unless you live in Santa Barbara or San Diego, your climate's ideal, or Maui. Maui's pretty nice, too. It's cold, it's hot, there's deserts, there's floods, there's all kinds of things. But what we have had for quite a few years is stability. And because of the stability, we have had the foundations of human civilization, agriculture. Because if you planted one year, more or less, you kind of knew that same stuff was going to grow in the same place the next year. So here's a graph out of this guy named Burroughs. He wrote a great book called Climate Change in Prehistory. And similar to Kathleen's graphics here, or Catherine's graphics, the right-hand side is, I call it, my technical term is really, really old. Present over here. So time, old to new. This is change. This is not the average climate. This is just how much the climate is changing on sort of like decadal to century type scales. And there's a lot. This is like really unstable. This is really stable. Change, 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 and then nothing. So if you read this guy, Nicholas Wade, he wrote a great book called Before the Dawn, kind of talks about using DNA testing and genetics. The bottom line of that book is the brains we have in between our ears today, basically our ancestors 50,000 years ago had those same brains. They weren't stupider than us. They had the same brains that we do. But why did it take until, you know, roughly 10 to 13,000 years ago for us to come up with agriculture and then civilization, and the next thing you know, we're all carrying these things around? You know, was it because these guys were, like, not capable? I would argue in large part they were just using that gray matter to try and survive in this amazingly unstable climate. And, you know, the world population back then was a few million, maybe a million, maybe a couple million. It was not 7 billion with a B. So the real threat that I see is if we, through our actions, kind of stepping on the gas pedal, push the climate back into a more unstable regime, then we're going to have real, real problems. I mean, it's bad enough that we're going to change the average, but if we go back to this unstable regime, that's the real, you know, you talk about thinking the unthinkable, that's the bad scenario there. Okay, how do we know this is happening? One of my previous jobs, I was a navigator on a guided missile destroyer. This was in the age, 90% of you can't even imagine this was true, but there was an age before we had global positioning system. You did not just take this thing out and it told you to within 15 meters on the Earth's surface of where you were. There wasn't a time when you didn't do that. So it turns out that if you wanted to stay navigator and not all of a sudden find yourself working as the greeter at the local Walmart, you paid attention to a lot of different data sources. You didn't trust any one thing totally, but what you did do is you took a bunch of independent stuff, you used that stuff in between your ears there to come up with an assessment to say, am I where I think I am? Am I going in the right direction? How's all this working? That's kind of how I look at the data, the observations on climate change. Because, you know, you hear all this stuff in the media, oh my God, they dropped off this observation, that's not true, this is there. You know, okay, that's noise, frankly. You know, you can argue the minutiae about any given data set, and you can. But when you start looking at Earth temperatures, ocean temperatures, deep ocean temperatures, ice retreating, sea ice, land ice, ecosystems migrating, you have to come up with a really, really, really complex hypothesis to sort of explain all that stuff if you still believe that the climate isn't changing. So here's just, this is sort of on the communication side. This is sea ice. We know sea ice does not impact sea level. But what you can see is this is, you know, just a visual representation of how the ice in the Arctic has changed. The white stuff is the really hard, multi-year thick ice. Watch what happens here about now. That's 2007, 08, 09, 10, 11. It ain't there anymore. It's gone. That, ladies and gents, has happened within all of our lifetimes. That is, I would argue, the hugest change that we have seen on planet Earth in many, 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 many tens of thousands of years. And it's happened in the last decade. It's happening right now. That is a massive, massive change in the Arctic, and we don't see it going back. There is no evidence to date right now that that multi-year ice will come back in any significant form, so we're going to go to seasonal ice. I told the head of the Navy, I think that by the late 2020s, so let's say 15 years from now, we'll probably have about a month of basically no ice in the Arctic. Now, I told him that 4 years ago. People thought I should be, like, you know, taken down and given a drug test because that was just, like, too wild a prediction. If anything, I might be too conservative on that prediction there. So this is a huge change. Okay, we heard a little bit about, you guys know, like, why Willie Sutton robbed banks, right? It's where the money was. Well, why do you study the ocean if you're interested in climate? It's where the heat is. 90%, 85 to 90% of all the heat is in the ocean. And as we watch that ocean warm up, I mean, that's, again, that's 90% of the solution there. Sea level rise, the details are not important, but what a bunch, 3, 4, 5 independent measurements, data sets all tell us is that the sea level's coming up. We're now seeing it coming up somewhere between 1 and 2 centimeters each year. And what these graphs show on the right here is this is based on some satellite data. It's actually looking at gravity measurements on both the West Antarctic ice sheet and Greenland. And we're starting to see a lot of that ice increasingly come off, both melting and then just frankly flowing into the ocean. That becomes the wild card that was referred to by the previous speaker. The IPCC said back when they were doing all this stuff that they didn't really know. There's been a ton of research on that. I would say, and again, I've told the Navy, I'm on record both in Congress and in the Navy on this, that look for about a meter, a little over 3 feet, of average sea level rise between the year 2000 and the year 2100. But if I'm wrong, I'm probably wrong on the low side. There is a fat tail. There is a fat tail to that. Okay, back to communications. So what does all this stuff mean? That was my house in Waveland, Mississippi. Anybody here know where Waveland, Mississippi is? Couple. Okay, it's on the Gulf Coast. It's almost in Louisiana, but not quite. There's a little squall that went through there in 2005, Katrina. We were about 10 miles away from where Katrina made landfall. So what that house then looked like was that. That's my house. That's me trying to figure out what do we do next. The good news is this is what the lot actually looked like when we got there. It's not like we'd worked for a month and cleaned it up. So when we say we lost our house, we really have no idea where it went to this day. I think it got sucked out to sea, but I'm not sure. It also, its last great act of defiance was to take out a really ugly house just upstream of us, so I think it did some good. The entire street looked like this. The entire coast looked like this. So again, I am not saying that Katrina is climate change, but I am saying that severe, strong storms with surges. This was about 30 feet of water going up our street. I mean, having lived there for 5 years, it's still hard for me to imagine what 30 feet of water going up that street looks like. But you can sure see what it did. You know, we were elevated, we were above the FEMA flood zones, da-da-da, all that kind of, you know, bureaucratic crap. The ocean didn't really care. So that's what storm surge looks like when you're the owner of a house. Okay, you guys can read this here. Really, there's a couple classes or a few classes I'll put or vectors of impacts to the national security establishment on sea level rise. One is, very frankly, infrastructure. The Department of Defense in general and the Navy in particular puts a lot of their bases, they're near the coast. They're right on the coast. This is a true story. I really had somebody, after I went through my little spiel, ask me, well, why does the Navy build their bases on the coast? And he said, well, it's kind of a ship thing, you know? Ships are at sea, they're on the sea level, kind of by definition, that's where we want our bases. You know, the Navy building a base in Albuquerque to get away from the sea level rise, while that's interesting, it's not going to be very effective. So I really did get that question. My best question so far. Maybe you guys will ask a better one. We'll see. So the infrastructure is huge. It's at least hundreds of billions of dollars. My guess is it could be trillions, and especially when you start looking at all the civilian-type things that have to move. So you'll see a couple logos down here. This is the Army Corps of Engineers. Here's a group that I'll guarantee you nobody in this audience has heard of. Strategic Environmental Resource Defense Program. Basically, these guys are the pros from Dover that are charged to figure out these specific amounts of how much sea level is going to come up by bases. They work directly for the Secretary of Defense. They're co-funded with the Department of Energy. NOAA plays well with them. And that kind of work is in progress right now. So I mentioned there's the infrastructure. It's not just in the U.S. Bases and forward operating locations are still very critical around the world. And if you start having the significant inundation in there, you also have the issue. And then what is also being talked about today several times is as you have those sea levels rise, you know, what does that do to stability of countries? What happens if you have forced migration for island nations of hundreds of thousands of people? Is that orderly? Is it not orderly? If it's not orderly, it probably becomes a national security issue. Treaty of Westphalia, you know, we don't move around like those people who were really dealing with climate change tens and tens of thousands of years ago. So we kind of can go two ways here. We can either look at climate change as a common threat, a common enemy, if you will, and band together despite political differences with countries. Or the other side of game theory is every person for themselves, and then things get really bad. So if you guys or gals run for office, figure out which side of that equation you want to be on. Okay, so here's, you know, for our lifetimes and our children's lifetimes, the numbers to look at and the places to look at are in the dark red. The 0 to 1, maybe up to about 2 meters or something like that. So, you know, oh, by the way, that place in Waveland, I just have the slabs, so I, you know, if anybody wants to buy a place in Waveland, come see me afterwards. It is on the market now. You know, down south of Miami, I don't know if, I'm sure somebody here, some people here have, like, you know, when you fly out of Miami, you know, if you're on the correct side of the aircraft, you look down. And to me, it always looks like the sea's about that far below the land. It's like right on the land. It's not going to take a whole lot of sea level rise to make those guys have a lot of trouble. Now, if that's not enough fun for them, you know, the geology, it's mostly limestone. So you can build the biggest levee in the world. The water's going to kind of think it's funny because it's just going to come up under it anyways. So they got a real, there's some real challenges there. Norfolk, although it's kind of hard to see on this scale, has got real challenges as well, and I'll talk about that a little bit more in a second. But it's not, of course, just the United States. Here is what those elevations look like in Bangladesh, kind of the poster child for sea level rise. There we go. Here is a place that maybe not too many people have heard of. It's a little island in the middle of the Indian Ocean. It's called Diego Garcia. British Indian Ocean territory, thank you. But the U.S. kind of uses it, like 95%, 98%. But that runway there are pier facilities. It is an incredibly important logistics base to the Department of Defense. So if this floods out, and it's only a couple, 3 meters high, that means capability-wise that the DOD needs to invest in a lot more capability to basically do without this. So that's cost as well as actual specifics of what we need. Okay, who remembers this rather famous Irishman here? Tip O'Neill, right? What did he say about politics? All politics is local. Well, that's kind of how I look at sea level rise, because it turns out all sea level rise is local too. So we've been talking about this big global sea level rise part. There's two other components. It turns out that there's a local component, and it depends on the big currents. So here, just for orientation, that's Florida, Outer Banks, Chesapeake Bay, you know, New England, Long Island up here. This is a computer model from the Naval Oceanographic Office of the Gulf Stream. Well, it turns out it looks like the Gulf Stream is slowing down. Why do I care? Why does that matter to sea level rise? Well, it turns out that the stronger that current flows on the cold or the north side, it depresses sea level, and on the warm side, it raises. So you can think if it slows down, you start getting more of an equilibrium. That's bad if you're like, oh, in Norfolk. So that local sea level rise is coming up. And if that's not enough, the land itself is sinking for reasons nothing to do with climate change. It's all about the retreat of the ice ages. But the land itself is going down. the local effect is coming up and the global effect is coming up. So they've got a real problem there. Okay, boring bureaucracy, this looks like. It's a bunch of reports. But actually, that kind of counts, because without the analytical framework and sort of looking at this, and I'll show you in kind of terms of almost how do you do a turnaround on a big organization, without that analytical framework, you don't get anywhere. So, I mean, you know, I can stand up and Titley can say this and say that, and it's like, yeah, that's nice. But until you have things like the National Defense Science Board, the Ocean Studies Board, which is part of the National Academy, so it's sort of the, hey, we've had the best minds in the country look at this. Well, by the way, they kind of say what I'm telling you right now. But you have to do that. You have to do that before you can actually get real meaningful action, certainly in the Defense Department and, frankly, in large parts of the other government as well. Some additional national security studies. I know the one on the left. This is done by Mike McElroy. It is, he's out of Harvard. It's very good. It's very readable. And it really talks about some of the implications. So if anybody's interested, this is you can just Google the Center for the Environment, Climate Extremes, and you'll find it. The Columbia one is very good. It tries to link, okay, so how, besides infrastructure and besides the Arctic, is climate change actually going to impact national security? I think it is up on the web. I haven't looked recently. It was November of 12. He goes through six sort of classes, resource competition, the globalization, and if you disrupt part of globalization. In the interest of time, unfortunately, I can't go through all of that. But if you're interested in a class or just for research, it's a pretty good book. This is Mike's quote that I pulled out of the report on the left-hand side, and I think that kind of sums up things pretty well. Some pragmatic things we can do is we can frankly work on better models. People may have heard in the popular media how the Europeans have better models than the United States. I started work on this like 3 years ago to try to get one model for the United States, because we have a whole bunch, and again, it's a story that's too long to tell right now. But despite all the silliness of sequestration and all the politics and stuff, I'm very happy to say this is actually funded. It survived all the budgets. The Navy has $25 million in this over the next 5 years, which is enough to make them a serious partner and intentionally not enough to do it, because I want partnership. I don't want everybody doing their own thing. I cannot overemphasize leadership. Leadership really does matter. This is the Secretary of the Navy. He's been working very, very hard on energy. Energy is, frankly, the other side of the coin of climate change. In all the public testimony and statements, you will not see the Navy talk about energy in terms of climate change. Why? Because the Navy is not stupid. And they want their funding. And in our political system, that means the House of Representatives has to approve it. That's just the way it works. However, there are tremendous arguments that do not have to do with climate change as to why we need to radically re-engineer our energy sources, including biofuels, renewables, demonstration projects. It looked like this was dead in the water, no pun intended, last summer with the House. This guy here, Secretary of the Navy, basically took him on and won, and it's funded. So that is a good news story, but it's leadership. It's leadership. Okay, it's change management. This comes out of Cotter, but you know, if you don't like Cotter, you can go to Covey. If you don't like Covey, find your favorite MBA guru out of like the Sloan School or whatever. You know, establish urgency, get a team together, a vision, communicate that vision, get people to start doing it, some actual progress, and get it into the culture. And that's what you gotta do. I told you, this is now the current boss of the Navy. He has kept the momentum on the Arctic and on sea level rise. There, if you wonder what your Navy does, in six words, three statements, that's what it does. But this is really how do we change. And a lot of times what happens is we have a bunch of scientists up there say it's going to be really bad, and then we wonder why nothing happens. And it's like, well, you know, you're not really doing this. And as a result, you don't get action. Okay. Did I mention that leadership counts? Who's this guy? This guy is Admiral Sam Locklear. He is the head in the Department of Defense of all U.S. forces in the Pacific Ocean. He was interviewed 5 weeks ago by the Boston Globe, asked what the most significant threat was. Now, he has China, Japan, Korea, you know, Little Kim, all those guys, South China Sea, a lot of stuff in his area. He said it's climate change. And specifically, he called out rising sea levels. This comment, those statements are incredibly hard for the traditional defense establishment, security establishment to write off. Titley can say something that's like, you know, you're a two-star, you're a weather guy. It's like, yeah, whatever. When are you retiring now? Oh, remind me again. You can't write off the head of the Pacific Command. Leadership counts. The only surprise I'll see is if there are no more surprises. This is Richard Alley working on the glaciers. This whole wild card of how much of that ice on Greenland and West Antarctic comes in, that is the wild card. What's going on in the deep oceans? We really have no idea. That's Alvin from Woods Hole. What's this? It was sort of mentioned a little bit. Geoengineering. If it doesn't scare you, it probably should. This is intentional man-made modification to try to undo the stuff we've done. No problems there, right? And who's this guy? This guy's Niels Bohr. What did he say? He said predictions are tough, especially when they're about the future. So I would argue for humility. And when we think we know what 20 or 30 years from now is going to be like, remember Mr. Bohr there, because we'll probably be wrong. Okay, I'll just wrap up here. Why do I have Winston Churchill up here? What did he say about Americans? Americans can always be counted upon to do the right thing after exhausting every other possibility. So we're probably in the process right now of exhausting every other possibility, but we'll get there. Now, if you don't want him, I mean, we got an airport for this guy, right? Just down the road, John Wayne. What did he say? He said life was tough, but it's tougher if you're stupid. So let's not be stupid, okay? I think ultimately we will get there. We may do it with duct tape, and we may have some mission damage. It may take something like Atlanta running out of water to get our attention, or some kind of seminal event like that. And we'll probably spend more money than we needed to, and we probably won't have the same number of options that we had wished we had. But at the end, I think we'll figure this out, and we will ultimately save at least enough. We have had really bad-looking periods in our history before, and ultimately we'll figure it out. And that's all I have. Thanks very much.
I mean, I think both of us are on the same page in actually suggesting that things are kind of quite dramatic in terms of the science, and they're, you know, probably a lot kind of more dramatic than a lot of publics engage with. But I was just interested. It's kind of a very pragmatic question in the way in which the kind of Navy is planning for civil, managing civil disasters and the impacts of climate change, and what the kind of role is seen in terms of actually responding to disasters that are kind of, you know, are civil disasters rather than military disasters.
There's part of that maritime strategy I kind of made fun of with those six things. The last part of that is what we call, we got to have an acronym because it's the Department of Defense, HADR, which stands for Humanitarian Assistance and Disaster Relief. It turns out it's relatively simple for the military to do that stuff. The United States military, because we have big transport, big communications, we're good at working in uncertain and non-permissive environments, you can bring order to chaos, all that kind of thing, and we have capability. So when you talk about this in the Pentagon, people say, well, okay, we already got that capability, you know, and are we really going to build more? Well, militaries are expensive, and if you really need more, well, maybe you should think of like a civil auxiliary or something that really that's what they do. It will frankly be a lot cheaper than trying to build in additional capacity to the military. So if all I did was talk about we'll have more disasters, more humanitarian assistance, I would get greeted with collectively a big yawn in the Pentagon because they say, we can already deal with that. We have capacity. Thanks. I'm kind of busy. Next issue. Whereas if I talk about it in terms of an ocean opening up that has not done that in 500 years, well, last time we had a new ocean for the Western militaries was some guy named Columbus. So a new ocean is a big deal. and how do you work in that ocean in very harsh, very austere, even with the ice going, conditions, no infrastructure. We've heard a lot this morning about that. And the whole sea level rise and changing the infrastructure, that's the way you get sort of that $500 billion organization interest. You got to show how it's a different problem than the problems that we already deal with today.
Do you have something to ask or question or applaud from Kathy?
Well, just one comment. I was actually, we believe it or not, had never met each other till last evening, had not coordinated our slides. I was actually amazed at how much in common from very different perspectives we have. So that was just one comment. I saw you had a picture in one of your early slides, the World According to 2050 by Smith, I think, Lawrence Smith. I like that book. I was surprised you had it because he doesn't talk about catastrophes except in the very last part. So I'm just curious as to why did you use that as sort of one of your books?
I was just kind of, it wasn't really the text, it was the front cover that just the way in which this kind of flooded imagination is kind of very much how we configure climate change. But I wonder if I could just very quickly, before we open up to the audience, just ask you about the Arctic. And I think that's also something that we might have in common. And obviously a changing Arctic, I think in your language, a changing battle space environment. How does the Navy, given its kind of history in the Arctic, actually start talking to, I mean, the people we heard from this morning, and communities, indigenous communities in the Arctic? What's the dialogue there?
I think the dialogue is really with the states, with the tribes, with the Coast Guard. Coast Guard's been up there, and the Coast Guard's learned, United States Coast Guard. I spent a bunch of time in Canada, so going around up to, I think I've seen more of the Arctic than 95% of the Canadians have, of their Arctic, because I've been up to Resolute Bay and Cambridge Bay and Yellowknife and all this kind of thing. So it's a long-term thing. The Navy's history, just to be very, very blunt about it, its interest in the Arctic has been episodic. The U.S. Navy has been interested, but it's basically based when there is something to be interested about. I believe plus $2 buys you a 20-ounce soda, but I believe that as the ice melts, and I think we go to a seasonal ice rather than permanent ice, that will change from episodic to permanent. But this is something I've talked about to Navy leadership is, you know, how do we work there? How do we understand traditional knowledge? Admiral Allen, who was the former head of our Coast Guard, had wonderful stories. You know, he was working with some of the indigenous peoples and said, you know, geez, you know, you guys are out on these kayaks and, you know, you don't even have life preserves. So here's Coast Guard life preserves. You know, it'll help save you. They wouldn't wear them. Why? Well, they were red. It's like, why don't you wear them? Well, and where's our folks from Alaska? You know, we don't want to be targets of polar bears. It's like, oh, we hadn't thought about that. So there's thousands of years of knowledge that we can either take advantage of or we can learn ourselves. You know, my recommendation is we do it the first one.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.